A year ago this week, everything changed as Britain followed many other countries into complete lockdown, disrupting our lives in a way that nobody could have ever imagined. Over the next two episodes, we're looking back at this momentous period of history we've all lived through. Starting today with a scientist who was at the heart of major government decisions, Professor Niall Ferguson. And then tomorrow, looking at the impact on those who were told that they should shield and not leave their homes at all. The first time that scientist Niall Ferguson dropped a data bombshell that dramatically changed the government's approach to combating an infectious disease was not in March 2020, but March 2001. He and his imperial team of scientists had found a line of rundown terraced houses in London where they plugged in their computers to create a makeshift data lab.
We were using, relatively simple models in a fairly temporary accommodation in Paddington.
The disease was foot and mouth.
For 6 weeks now, Britain has been gripped by an epidemic of foot and mouth disease.
And it was fast turning into a crisis.
We were interested in how quickly it was spreading, the fact that it was detected quite late and therefore had seeded across the country.
From Cumbria in the north to Essex in the east, from Wales in the west to Gloucestershire in the south.
And then undertook a very rapid analysis, along with a couple of other groups in the UK, to really look initially at how fast was it spreading and was the current government, measures getting the outbreak under control. We concluded quite rapidly that it wasn't.
Just as would happen again 20 years later, the modelling had churned out the outcome that politicians were dreading.
The day we presented our analysis was the same day that the Secretary of State for Agriculture stood up in the Commons saying the outbreak was all under control.
The data would force Tony Blair's government to face up to reality, and it ordered the unprecedented culling of more than 6 million cattle, sheep and pigs. Helping to bring the disease under control would earn Ferguson an OBE and cement his position as one of the country's leading epidemiologists, a role that would thrust him into the public glare in 2020, when the world was hit by the worst pandemic for a century. In Britain, his models would once again change everything, this time earning him the nickname Professor Lockdown. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, Professor Niall Ferguson on the year that shattered our way of life. When did you first hear about COVID-19 and how worried were you initially?
Very late December, very early January, I think, I heard on ProMed, which is a mailing list for infectious diseases, about a novel pneumonia outbreak cluster in Wuhan. I didn't give it very much thought, and it certainly didn't work on it.
In central China, a man has died following an outbreak of an unknown pneumonia-like virus, which officials say comes from the same family as the deadly SARS virus. Health authorities say that only 40 other people are infected.
When I first heard of a case being discovered in a traveller to Thailand, that concerned me.
The patient arrived at a Bangkok Suvarnabhumi Airport from Wuhan last week with a high fever and was quarantined.
And the reason that concerned me is because at the time, the messages from China was this was a small contained outbreak and there wasn't any evidence of human-to-human transmission. But the fact that one person turned up infected in Thailand immediately told me that there had to be 10 to 100 times more infected people in Wuhan.
And early on in January, members of the Government Science Advisory Committee, SAGE, got together, including yourself, Chris Whitty, Patrick Vallance and others. What did you discuss?
It was really an exchange of views. I expressed my concerns that it was likely this was spreading to person, though we didn't have definitive estimates of how quickly. We had no real handle on exactly how lethal it was. And so at that point, there was a concern, otherwise that committee would not have been stood up. but it hadn't escalated to the point it did certainly 2 or 3 weeks later.
Wuhan and central China and nearby cities in lockdown, not a soul to be seen.
January the 23rd, the whole world knew it was very serious just from the fact that China had locked down.
The new strain, not previously identified in humans, is causing alarm, though the World Health Organization says it's too early to declare an international public health emergency.
I mean, there was no advice at that time to close the borders or to start entry screening. In fact, I read one piece of advice suggesting the costs of entry screening could be higher than the potential benefits. With the clarity of hindsight, which obviously is a wonderful thing, was that a mistake?
I think the challenge there is that I think just the previous year or 2 years earlier, there had been a significant human outbreak of influenza virus in China associated with exposure to markets. So the problem is always calling wolf. If you have very little information to go on, it is a brave politician, brave scientific advisor for that matter, who says you must take draconian action with basically very little information, even if there are concerns. But if we'd had perfect information back in middle to late January, then there would have been serious consideration, clearly, of shutting the borders, despite the fact it would have been a very difficult thing for the UK to do.
By February the 12th, you went on the Today programme. You said we were in the early phases of a global pandemic.
I think we're in the early phases of a global pandemic at the moment. The fact we've only reported 8 cases in this country is just because, again, our surveillance is focused on travellers. We think probably we're picking up maybe 1 in 3 cases coming into the country at the current
time. Not long
time.
After that, we know that Italy went into crisis. It locked down.
Imposing restrictions on about 100,000 people and shutting down public gatherings in 2 regions of northern...
I remember government advisers suggesting at the time they thought that was mad and that we wouldn't be doing something like that.
I was at a hospital the other night where I think there were actually a few coronavirus patients, and I shook hands with everybody, you'll be pleased to know, and I continue to shake hands. And
at that time, we were following a policy known as mitigation, which was essentially to try to slow the spread of COVID, but not stop it in its tracks and only isolate the most vulnerable.
Our judgment is washing your hands.
And in fact, there was even talk about trying to achieve herd immunity. Boris Johnson actually went on to Breakfast Television on March the 5th and said one theory was to take it on the chin and let it spread.
Take it on the chin, take it all in one go and allow the disease, as it were, to move through the population.
Do you know where that was coming from?
I mean, yes, the main focus, by the time an epidemic is well established in the UK, the main focus of past pandemic plans was on mitigation, minimising the number of people who would die, but not stopping it altogether, for the simple reason that trying to stop it altogether leaves you in this enormously costly regime of needing to keep in place, you know, social distancing measures until you finally get vaccine. And for a disease where you don't have a vaccine when you're starting, you're heading down a very difficult path. We discussed, you know, mitigation and suppression multiple times on the SAGE committee for exactly that reason, that we were, if there was any way of avoiding it, then going into a scenario where you were stuck in some form of social distancing and for quite a lot of the time full-blown lockdown with the economic consequences we've seen, if there had been a way of avoiding it, I'm sure the government would have wanted to take it. I mean, unfortunately, the science and the analysis showed that it was unavoidable.
When did you realise that moving towards a full lockdown was unavoidable?
What happened over a period of a week or two, really from, I mean, it was the first weekend in March, and Sunday we had a kind of meeting with senior analysts from NHS England, but it was clear by the end of that meeting that we were likely facing quite catastrophic levels of healthcare demand. What became clear is that if we adopted a mitigation policy, then there wasn't any scenario where the health system would not be overwhelmed and we wouldn't see hundreds of thousands of deaths. So it was impossible to make that sort of strategy work in a way that you actually could have an acceptable outcome.
There now follows a ministerial broadcast from the Prime Minister.
Good evening. The coronavirus is the biggest threat this country has faced for decades, and this country is not alone. All over the world, we're seeing the devastating impact of this invisible killer. And so tonight, I want to update you on the latest steps we're taking to fight the disease and what you can do to help.
What difference would it have made if we'd locked down a week earlier?
It's not so much locking down a week, it's moving all the policy decisions back a week. So we went into a sort of semi-lockdown on March 16th, which was kind of Swedish-style, almost voluntary, and then a compulsory lockdown on March 23rd.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home.
If we move both of those back, then the epidemic mid-March was doubling every 3 or 4 days, roughly. So moving it back a week would have at least halved the size of the first wave of the pandemic. But it has to be said that now of the 140,000 or more deaths the UK has seen, about a third of them occurred in that first wave. So we would have probably more than halved that initial death toll.
Wow. Even if the first wave was smaller, that is over 20,000 lives. Whose decision was it? Were scientists telling ministers to go earlier?
So there were multiple things in play. I think what really happened in the week of March 13th, that we started finally getting systematic surveillance data coming through from hospital testing. And what that made us realise is that there was a lot more infection in the country than previous testing of travellers and contact tracing, which was going on, which was very much focused on travellers, had given us any indication. So basically 2 to 3 times more infection in the country than previous testing had indicated. And that meant the pandemic had progressed a lot further than we'd anticipated. And that is what really escalated decision making. Now, as to the decision as to whether to go to immediately to a mandatory lockdown or to a kind of softer voluntary lockdown, that was entirely in the government's hands.
And so we did finally go into lockdown, but during all of that time, weirdly, face-to-face meetings had gone ahead behind the scenes. Meetings that were to literally plan out social distancing measures. You yourself contracted COVID, as did the Prime Minister and many others.
Boris Johnson says that he is in good spirits after spending the night in hospital with coronavirus. The Prime Minister was taken to St Thomas's Hospital in London on Sunday evening.
In fact, we now know it was raging through Westminster. You recovered, of course, carried on with your work. By then, your life had changed dramatically. You'd gone from someone who, I'll admit, I hadn't heard of before to one of the kind of most well-known names in the country. And of course, in the end, that led to, I guess, a scandal for you when a newspaper showed that you'd been breaking the rules.
Neil Ferguson, one of the better-known names, better-known scientists in the COVID-19 episode, has resigned from the government committee that advises the ministers as to what to do to fight the pandemic. It appears, according to the Daily Telegraph, that he's been allowing his lover to visit him at home, another married woman. That would, in fact, breach government...
Just tell me what that was like for you.
I mean, I'd say the whole experience of becoming a public figure this year has, in the last 12 months, has been a somewhat surreal one. I mean, it has its plus points in the sense that I've always enjoyed kind of communicating the science I do and to the public. But I'm also quite a private person, not a natural extrovert. And so it certainly is unpleasant being in the public gaze, putting the kind of May and the kind of breaking lockdown rules on one side, which kind of clearly, as I've said before, I regret deeply. But it is quite strange to have every public comment you make being repeated in multiple newspapers. It's a very surreal experience.
On the breaking the rules, like, obviously you thought you'd had COVID, you'd be safe. But did you think in retrospect, like, imagine if everyone else had thought that?
Yes. And I mean, I did exactly the wrong thing. I mean, to be honest, I was working 18-hour days and wasn't actually thinking it through very clearly. I've apologised for it and I will do so again.
you know, I get it, right? You had to resign or you had to step back from Sage. Obviously, you carried on doing your work. But Matt Hancock said he'd back police action against you.
It's a matter for the police. As a government minister, I'm not allowed to get involved in the operational decisions of police matters, even though I've got a clear answer to what I think.
He didn't mention anything when other Tory colleagues broke the rules. And then we, of course, had the Dominic Cummings scandal.
We agreed that we should go for a short drive to see if I could drive safely. We drove for roughly half an hour and ended up on the outskirts of Barncastle town. We did not visit the castle. We did not walk around the town.
That must have been a little bit irritating for you to watch.
I mean, they're not exactly comparable incidents. I was never employed by the government. I've always been an unpaid advisor whilst Dominic Cummings' job was on the line. Let's say I was conscious of the difference, how the two incidents were handled and the comments of ministers. I have to say, I got some contacts, informal contacts from senior Conservative MPs, including some in the government, saying they were quite shocked and about what had happened to me.
So by June, 40,000 people had died, but finally the death rate was falling. It had gone from over 1,000 a day in April to below 100 by then. And we moved towards the end of lockdown for most of the country. Summer brought some welcome relief. Hairdressers and pubs opened. There was eat out to help out. People went on holiday. But then in September, things worsened. And once again, the advice from scientists was to lock down.
Sage has advised that a circuit breaker should act to reduce R below one, should reset the incidence of disease to a lower level, and should set the epidemic back by approximately 28 days or more.
But that advice was not heeded. Did that delay once again lead to a higher death rate than we might have seen?
Yes, undoubtedly. I mean, I was involved in that advice as well. Even I wasn't attending SAGE meetings, but I think it was very unfortunate that the lessons from the first wave, namely that acting earlier saves lives and doesn't actually have a higher economic cost than acting later, that lesson wasn't learned. And that's not unique to this country. It wasn't learned across Europe. And I think reflects the kind of fragmentation of the political consensus around the response to COVID, which had happened by then, partly fueled by COVID skeptics, partly fueled by, well, a whole range of things. So unfortunately, governments across Europe only really acted once they saw exponentially increasing numbers of cases in hospitals, rather than believing the data from their test and trace system, what that was telling them. But undoubtedly, had we acted earlier, we would have reduced deaths. We would have still then needed to lock down again and probably again after that when case numbers resurged. I mean, nobody could have predicted the new variant, and it has to be said, the new variant, which started really taking off in November and December, has accounted for over half the deaths due to this pandemic in the UK.
But they knew about that by December when they still allowed people to meet at Christmas.
I've no doubt that people will be able to have as normal a Christmas as possible, and that we'll be able to get things open before Christmas as well.
Yes, and I suppose that's I was encouraged, maybe glass half full rather than glass half empty, I was encouraged that control measures, tier four was introduced, Christmas mixing was basically stopped in areas where the new variant was really taking off. And so there was a lot of tightening up. I mean, with the exception of Christmas Day, we were effectively, at least in the south of England, southeast, east of England, London, we were effectively in lockdown over most of Christmas. And schools were importantly shut. And the closure of schools, I think, is the big difference between the third lockdown, which was imposed in January of this year, and the second lockdown. And what our modelling showed was that the second lockdown was not sufficient to control this new variant. You needed to have schools shut to control it.
The United Kingdom has recorded the highest number of COVID deaths in a 24-hour period since the pandemic struck last year, at more than 1,600. Experts say it's likely that the coming weeks will see figures even higher than this.
And of course, by the end of that wave, the death rate was far higher than we could ever have imagined. At one point, there were hopes that we could limit deaths to 20,000. A year on, it's 125,000 who have died within 28 days of a diagnosis, and more like 140,000 who've had COVID on their death certificate. Some of that has been driven by delays in decision making. Now, you say it's for politicians to decide rather than scientists, but politicians don't understand this stuff, do they? It's complex science.
To be clear, I mean, it's absolutely scientific advisors' role to explain the science and explain the consequences of that science for policy. And absolutely, the closest I got to saying this is what you need to do was in the meetings running up to the publication of Report 9, which basically said there is no other policy which will prevent the health service being overwhelmed and hundreds of thousands of deaths. That's not quite the same as saying the government needs to do this, but is getting very close to it. It's saying this is the only policy option. At other points in the pandemic, it hasn't been quite as black and white as that. I mean, I've made my own views clear as to the false dichotomy between, you know, imposing measures early and more strictly versus ranking the economy more highly. The fact that it is a false dichotomy and the evidence of the last now 14 months has proven that is, I think, clear cut. I still think it is a political judgment to make to balance these things when you actually have to make those decisions in real time.
Okay, because locking down later probably lengthened the time we were under restrictions, so arguably meant hurting the economy more. Now, you told my colleague, Robin McKee, that you were 80% sure the country would be in a different place in a few months. Sounds like you're hedging your bets there. But what did you mean by that?
That wasn't intended to be a precise prediction. Our initial modelling and my judgment is that we're rolling out vaccination sufficiently fast that we will keep ahead of those variants, at least until the autumn, when we can basically boost people's immunity with top-up vaccination, preferably with vaccine doses which have been specifically made to tackle those Brazil and South African variants. So in that circumstance, I think there is a good chance that we will be able to keep to the government's roadmap out of lockdown, and that whilst not every measure may be relaxed by the summer, that it will feel a lot more normal.
Do you think we've had our last lockdown?
I'm hopeful we've had our last lockdown, and I think the balance of probability is in that direction, probably quite strongly, but there is a small risk, I mean, a significant risk, but I think the chance is probably quite low, posed by these additional new variants.
So the Prime Minister, perhaps not sensible, saying this will be an irreversible path out?
It's a slightly leading question. I mean, I actually, in this case, I think the government has taken the right approach of being relatively cautious, and I think that's exactly because they don't want to have to reimpose measures again. But clearly, and to be fair to the Prime Minister, I think he's even stated this, that, you know, if the circumstances warrant it, then there may be some reimposition of measures. I think that's unlikely, but it can't be completely ruled out.
And are you worried about autumn?
I think by the autumn, a different set of questions will come into play, and that will be very much around, can we encourage people to get their immunity boosted with a second dose? Can we keep the very high take-up of vaccine we've seen now? Because we will need to get revaccinated almost certainly. It might not be this autumn, but it will be in the next 12 months. Even once we've rolled out the first, you know, everybody's had two doses, there will be a need probably to boost immunity because it's not going to be lifelong. What we know about coronavirus is its immunity lasts a year or two.
Coming up, a year on, has Britain learned the lessons of COVID-19? It sounds like we shouldn't be thinking about a COVID zero outcome from any of this. And beyond that, what does everything that we've learned over the past year, particularly in the West, where we haven't had pandemics like SARS and MERS affect us in the past, change the way we're going to deal with future pandemics, both for the country, but also for you personally as someone who works in this field?
Yeah, so I don't think COVID zero is possible. This is going to be an endemic disease across the globe. I think we can turn it into a manageable disease where I mean, there will be people who die from it, but at much lower levels than we've seen in the last year. As to the long-term lessons, then I think the key lesson we should learn is to be able to, when we have new threats, be able to respond to them in terms of, you know, massively scaling up testing, particularly on borders, but also within our own country. We had this strange thing of, we had very limited testing, woefully inadequate, but of really only testing people with travel histories, whilst full knowing, and John Edmonds and myself were telling the government this, that we would not be picking everybody up. So I think testing at a very early stage in GPs, in hospitals, when you have good evidence of a newly spreading transmissible disease somewhere else in the world, testing not just people from, you know, one country, but, you know, trying to roll out large-scale testing of all travellers coming in. Those are the sorts of things which will give us a much earlier warning next time.
And of course, I know that this is with hindsight, but with hindsight, do you have a biggest regret?
I mean, my biggest regret is not pushing much harder, much earlier on around testing within the country so we had a better idea of what was really going on. Yes, I could have done more on that. It is very difficult to apply hindsight in these cases because, of course, you can go back and say, well, if I knew what I knew now, then I would have written the kind of perfect scientific advice to government, laying out exactly what the next year would look like. But actually being in the thick of things, of getting quite uncertain data and every day updating analyses, you learn more things all the time, and you're weighing up, not directly making decisions yourself, but you're weighing up, you know, policy decisions which will have enormous consequences for everybody in the country. Unless you're actually in that position, it's very hard to second guess what it's like, let's put it that way.
That was Professor Neil Ferguson. I mentioned that The Observer's science editor, Robin McKee, had interviewed him. Do look it up at theguardian.com. You can also read about Ferguson's comments regarding the struggle to keep the South African variant, which may be resistant to some vaccines, at bay. For more on the science and politics of all of this, do tune in regularly to The Guardian's Science and Politics Weekly podcast. That's it for now. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Paloma Kaufman. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Rachel will be back tomorrow with an episode all about the people who have had to shield over the past year.